Thanks, Larry. Lisa Lindsley?
I just like, thank you. I'd like to echo Larry's comments. As a consumer of financial statements, it would be very valuable to have the auditors review the MD&A, and whether you approach that from an AD&A methodology or directly with an MD&A, it would be helpful. And furthermore, I apologize for my ignorance, but I don't believe it currently exists, and it would be helpful to have auditors review the executive compensation disclosure that's in the proxy statements from the point of view of an investor.
Okay, thank you. Steve Rafferty.
Perhaps a few thoughts. Some of this, I think, is probably easy to get behind, the notion of describing the auditor's responsibility for fraud and disclosures, and some of that stuff, I think, is pretty easy to get behind. There's some of it, though, that is, I think, maybe a good thought, but hard to apply in practice. I mean, I think, first of all, I come at this from the standpoint that if you ask people if they want more information, their answer is likely to be yes. So, I mean, to some degree, I think that has happened here. And I don't doubt that investors do want additional information. One question is from whom? And the second question is what additional information? And from some of what I've heard, you could almost boil it down to say they want to know what they don't know, and they want to eliminate as many surprises as they can. And when I look at the eliminating surprises, you know, I look at, there's future events that none of us can predict that we can't talk about in the financials because we don't know about them. But what they also want to know about is what are the elements of the financial statements that are most subject to change and why? And which ones are hard to get your arms around from an estimating standpoint as a preparer and from an auditor? And why is that difficult? So what's the volatility in the financials? I could certainly see a model where you would make a more robust disclosure. Maybe it's in the financials that would just boil all that down into one spot and say, where's the volatility in these financial statements? And I could perhaps see even the auditors confirming that their audit included procedures to test those areas of the financial statements that are most volatile. But where I do struggle is to say that the auditors can describe it much about how they audited that would get an investor comfortable. I mean, you can't literally spend thousands and thousands of hours out auditing and boil that down to a paragraph that somebody says, gee, I learned a lot from that. I just don't think that's very, very practical. To me, it's a bit like if I get in an elevator in a 50-story building and I see the inspection certificate, I'm glad it's there. If you ask me would I like to know more about what they did to inspect that elevator, I might say yes. I wouldn't have a clue what they told me. So I don't know what I would do with that information. And I think it will end up being boilerplate. It will end up saying, I, as the auditor, identified the same volatility issues that the company did. I did procedures to get myself comfortable, and that's how I arrived at my opinion. But I don't think there's going to be sufficient detail that most folks could really do much with. I mean, we heard earlier today that audit committees don't really know the right questions to ask, so I have a hard time understanding how many investors are going to get their arms around something that auditors could say in a couple of paragraphs that people would be willing to read. So that's the part that I struggle with. I wouldn't have any trouble with saying, let's let the auditors confirm that they did identify the same areas and they spent time in those areas.
One of the things I heard you say, Steve, if I interpreted it correctly, was you're looking for some improvements in the financial statements, which would lay out particular risks in those financial statements, risks of potential measurement uncertainty, risks of volatility is the term you used, where numbers could change rapidly because of economic events, et cetera, to try to highlight in a particular footnote certain aspects that sort of might otherwise be brought out in this AD&A, put it in the financial statements, and have the auditor report on that. So that was an interesting variation on this theme. Thanks.
Joe, I know your card just went up, and I think I'd like to turn it over to you because I know you presented, you had worked with other weather members on the IAG last week and made a presentation. So I think you might be in a good spot to articulate what you heard or the results you found from your survey, why investors want this information from auditors, why they think that would be helpful, et cetera. And I don't know if you had any other comments.
Well, I was actually going to not try to say much, but I wanted to respond to, and I think, Jennifer, you and Marty both on Tuesday and today did a pretty nice job of describing our major findings, and I don't think they were really very different than what you found when you talked to investors. What I thought was good was we did a questionnaire. Your staff did focus groups, and I thought they aligned pretty nicely. But I wanted to respond, hopefully reasonably quickly, to some things that Larry said and some things that Steve said. I agreed with 90% of what Larry said and was pleased to hear what he said. The only thing I would quibble with a little bit, and maybe it's just difference of perception, is if I heard him right, he was talking about keeping management making assertions and auditors doing attestations, and that's not unreasonable. But keep in mind that in going concern, Larry, in my view, the auditor really is making an assertion there. Now, you might say implicitly management is saying it's a going concern, and the auditor is saying we disagree with that, and so we could have a quibble about that. But I think there's new information being communicated by the auditor there over and above what's in the financial statements, and that's why it's valuable. With respect to what Steve said, a couple of things, Steve. You said if you ask people if they want additional information, they are likely to say yes. Almost like this is a free good. And I would have tended to have maybe agreed with you. But in our questionnaire, one of the things we asked was, do you want additional information about audit hours? And it came back pretty definitively, no. And so it's not, they didn't view everything as if it's a free good. Just give us more, more, more. We'll take everything you want to give us. They differentiated. And there also was meaningful differences between things they really valued and things that, would it be okay, but it wasn't a big deal to them. Another thing you said is it would be hard to distill thousands of hours of work and thousands of pages of audit work papers into something that could be meaningfully conveyed in a more summarized fashion to investors. And again, I would quibble with that. Audit firms do that every day in summary audit memorandums. And summary audit memorandums lay out the major risk areas on the audit, what the team did, and how they got comfortable. And certainly the quality engagement partner relies on that. He or she also looks at the work papers. But I think firms could do this. It's not easy. I think it'll be challenging, but I think they could do it. I think the third point that you made that I want to say just a quick comment on is around boilerplate. And there I agree with you. I think the biggest, one of the biggest risks with this project is that all you end up with is additional cost and boilerplate language. And that would be a huge failure. And no one would benefit from that, I don't think. Certainly investors wouldn't benefit from that. So I think one of the things the board has to think about very carefully, not just as it relates to standard setting, but as it relates to inspection and, if necessary, enforcement, is put in place a strategy where that will not be an acceptable outcome.
Thank you, Joe. John White.
Thanks, Jennifer. I think I'm not going to follow your three buckets up there on the slide, but I did listen to the meeting on Tuesday and a replay of the investor group, so a couple of observations, three observations actually from that. First, I guess I would say that auditor association improves disclosure and compliance. And I guess just from my perspective as a lawyer, kind of watching the sausage be made over the years when people are drafting disclosures and so on, and working on IPOs and watching the whole process, It's very clear to me that if you had auditors associated with MD&A, you'd get a better MD&A. If you had auditors associated with the earnings press release, you'd have a better earnings press release. It just comes out that way. If you had auditors associated with the critical accounting policies part of it, just the result of that interaction and the involvement gets you to a better product. Second, and I guess this is really the AD&A idea. At least for me, and I know a number of you have heard me make this point before, but I think that that if you have an AD&A or something the equivalent of that, where you basically have what I'll call dueling reports, dueling views, one from the auditor, one from the preparer, or conflicting disclosures, whatever you want to call it, I just don't think that's a stable situation, and I don't think you end up with that lasting very long, if at all, in what comes out for a company. I think that in the end you gravitate to what the auditors are, the auditors' views. I just don't think a company wants to be there with their auditors saying, I'm just going to say negative things about them, however it comes out. So I think at the end of the day, you drift towards the auditor view if you've got two views being expressed. And then you flip over from that, and this kind of gets to the standardization and boilerplate point, but I guess I also don't see how an auditing firm can have hundreds of individual engagement partners out there engaged in free writing, anything, whether it's an AD&A or whatever it is, it's narrative. So you are going to end up with some sort of standardization coming down from the national offices from the accounting firms. And so I think the effect of all this, it seems to me, ends up with the national offices of the accounting firms imposing standardization on the audit partners or the individual audits, and then you flow that the individual audits are going to you're going to drift towards where the auditors are in each case. And I just, all of that doesn't seem to me to be a very good place for all of this to come out. And so, I mean, I realize this is a difficult issue, but if I sit here and think about how to balance it all, I think you're a lot better off trying to have as your goal figuring out how to come up with, I guess I would call it, one high-quality disclosure product for the investor, figuring out what the investor wants in that product, but one high-quality product that everybody agrees with. And with management having the pen on that, but figuring out whatever tools you need to give to the audit committee, give to the auditors to try to get an improved product. But I don't see what I guess I will call dueling products. And third point is cost. Inevitably, to me, I think you're naive to think that this isn't all going to cost more. Obviously, if you have the auditors associated with additional materials, that's pretty obviously going to cost more. But I think even if you have the auditors provide, and you talked about this a little bit at the earlier meeting, but if you have auditors provide information that you're going to say is already in existence because it was provided to the audit committee, it was done in this summary audit memorandum, once you have a narrative that the auditors have to write for each company, I love Jay's example of the emails, but I'll just add my own example. I get telephone calls from clients all the time. I give them advice over the phone. I charge whatever I charge for that. And then they say, well, could you give it to me in writing? I mean, have you dealt with lawyers? I mean, it just, if you're going to start writing opinions about it, if you're going to start writing it down, it's going to cost more. And I would suggest, actually, it's going to cost significantly more, particularly if you're focusing on the fact that this is information that investors really want. So as you, I'm not suggesting that it isn't money well spent, by the way. I mean, I leave that as a different discussion. I mean, I could easily see you deciding that an audit of MD&A was a good thing. It is money very well spent. But I, but this, but to think that any of this is not going to cost more, I think, is naive. Actually, one other comment. The example you gave about auditors writing due diligence reports in M&A transactions, I don't really think that's the right characterization. Accountants that are hired for the acquiring company, acting forensically and paid for the acquiring company, write due diligence reports. That auditors don't do that. Accountants do it. I mean, there's maybe the same people, but I mean, it's not very different roles, very different functions. Anyway, that's my thoughts.
Well, the guess what, in connection with MD&A, since you said it, wasn't the right example. You know, investors have told us that, you know, they say, you know, that they saw some similarities because they are the customer. Just, you know, if we could, you know, use a different term. You used accountant versus auditor. It's an accountant, not the auditor. But it's individuals with similar skill sets or, you know, providing information. Investors have told us, you know, that the auditors are working on behalf of investors. The audit report is signed to the board of directors and shareholders of the company. So that's the analogy they see. So, you know, we could have a discussion over differences. But I want to move on. I have five, unless another card just went up, but five cards to go through, and we've got about 10 minutes left. I know we have gone over in every session, but I think most people don't appreciate going over at the end of the day. So I'd like to, if you could try to keep your comments short to the extent you can, but it is important to us. So with that, I'll move on to Jim Cox.
Yeah, I was just going to make one of the points that John made, four points. I only had one point that would overlap, and that was the fact of this fear that it would be from a top-down, central-down sort of communication, that there wouldn't be this, John referred to, free riding, that it's not going to be tailored to that specific company, so therefore we'd be ending up with boilerplate. I think that's the challenge. You know, the other thing was to say that we need to figure out how to greet that challenge, to get back to a point that I think Barbara Roper made a couple times today, is that as we move more and more away from principles and more and more principles away from rules, rather, that judgments and estimates, we need to know more about those judgments and estimates to be able to really understand the statements. And I don't think those statements are the auditor's role is necessarily to provide, as Steve was saying, comfort to the investors. I think actually we probably ought to provide some level of discomfort to investors so they'd have some greater textured knowledge about the range of outcomes that would be possible, and they'd have a better idea about how wide that variance is if we could illuminate to some extent what the judgments and estimates and et cetera that went into the preparation of the statements.
Thanks, Jim. Arnie Hanisch.
Thanks, Jennifer. I've got several points I'd like to make. First of all, I do support some change, so I want to say that at the start. My preference, however, is to look at existing reports that are in our annual reports and modify those reports as opposed to a separate auditor's discussion and analysis. I think that there are opportunities within the existing reports to accomplish much of what you want to accomplish. As an example, and I agree with Larry, that management needs to assert and the auditors need to attest, but there are many things that our auditors do. For example, they do review our press release. They don't attest. They review. They provide us with insight. They review our MD&A. Provide us with their insights. They don't audit it. You know, if we want in the management's report section of the financial statements. We management could possibly indicate some additional things that the auditors are doing, or in the auditor's section of their report, they could indicate that they reviewed the press release, one or the other, but not necessarily indicate that it was part of the audit. But as part of our due diligence, we had our auditors review the MD&A. We had the auditors review the press release. If that would provide the investors with additional information as to what the auditors do, I think that there are ways within the auditor's opinion, at least in ours, in the second paragraph, that it could be expanded to include additional disclosure around the areas, more specifically around areas that they audited, that would probably parallel, in addition to the critical accounting policies, that those were areas of focus, that there were other things of focus of the audit, which is what they tell the audit committee when they go through and they tell the audit committee what were the primary areas of focus, you know, whether it was in addition to the critical accounting policies, acquisitions, restructurings, asset impairments, their perspective on the current credit crisis, that they reviewed issues and financial instruments and investments we may have had. But those could all be covered in an expansion of the second paragraph of the auditor's opinion, and it wouldn't necessarily be additional boilerplate, but it would be specific to a particular audit. The other thing I guess I'd like to comment on is that I really don't agree at all with the auditors having to audit the MD&A. We rely upon security lawyers, and as part of our process, we spend several hours with our security lawyers, external security lawyers, to review the MD&A. We value their opinion because the MD&A, from a legal perspective, is where we would be called on the carpet as a company. It's management's view of the financial statements. And they provide us, our security lawyers, provide us with their insights as to whether or not they think we've crossed the line from a disclosure perspective or not, or whether we need to go further because we're putting ourselves at risk as management with our MD&A disclosures from securities litigation. So I don't believe that it's the auditor's responsibility to audit that. They can review it. They can make sure that it's factual, which is what they do. They can review the numbers. And they can indicate that in the existing documents and the existing reports that are there. So those are my few comments.
That's interesting. Well, you mentioned some of the things that could be disclosed, which would be the auditor's review, the earnings releases, or press releases. Right now, that's not covered as part of the auditor's responsibility.
No, it's not. But I don't know if companies. You know, you could maybe build that into your auditor's responsibilities as part of your charge. I suspect that many companies, they have their auditors review their earnings releases, provide insight and comments. I value the insight and comment I get from the auditors, but I don't want them to necessarily be held responsible for it from an auditor's perspective. It's my press release.
We hear it's quite common, right, in larger companies that the auditors do that.
Right, right. But I want to stop short of having them audit it and attest, you know, and attest to it. They review it. They provide me with insight, just like they do with the MD&A, and that's what we should maybe disclose, that they provide that additional service as part of what they're currently doing, if that would provide additional comfort to investors.
Keith Kelhar.
Thank you.
I'm not sure I was next, but I'll speak quickly on this. I think much of the information that you spoke about that the investors are interested in receiving is already provided to the audit committee by the auditors. So I just wonder how much of the information that we give to the audit committee is really something that belongs in the public domain or belongs only, you know, with those individuals who have that responsibility. So that's just something I'm just going to throw out there because I've seen pretty much everything that was requested on that laundry list of things has always been in the audit committee materials I've looked at. I think what's most important in the things that I ask is what did the auditor not look at? So in other words, what exactly did they do with the MD&A? We read it. We saw it was consistent. That's fine. Just, you know, say that's what we did. Proxy statement, same thing. did they do anything? Did they just read it to see if it's consistent? Did they tick and tie the numbers? What did they do? So I think what's more important is the extent of the other financial information, which is not covered in all of the, you know, auditing standards, because I think there's a gap in understanding or the expectation of what people think the auditor's doing and what they're actually doing. So maybe to clarify that, not necessarily to go one step further to say they have to audit it, but just to say what really are they doing in that kind of the world of information that's very valuable to an investor but may or may not be getting the same level of scrutiny. And I don't have any particular issue with, I think some of the risk discussions that I've seen in a lot of the planning memos that go into the, you know, the beginning engagement information that's provided to the audit committee, I think that information is actually very good and maybe something that auditors want to have out there. It shows some real thoughtfulness, and I don't think any of it's really terribly alarming. So that's the kind of thing I would expect to see or hope to see. But other than that, I'm probably in the camp of not really sure that we need to make these changes. But if we're going down the path, then those are kind of my comments.
Thanks, Kiko. Lynn Turner.
I'd applaud Marty, the staff, and the board for taking this project on. It's been a long time coming. I think you heard last week that clearly investors aren't happy with the product, and not just from that group, but CFA Institute surveys. And also, if you're going to keep the product relevant, I think the relevancy is a legitimate question. I think Damon actually did raise a relevant question there. Then I think you got to put out a product that the customer is looking for, because without that, I think maybe 10, 20 years out, the product is no longer relevant and people find another way, especially when we're paying, in some cases, as the board heard, hundreds of millions of dollars for a report that's no different in 2006 versus 2007 or 8 and 9 on many of these large financial institutions. So I do think you're headed down the right path. I think you'll hear in some of the SEC, FASB, PCAOB public hearings this summer, you'll get some more feedback that I would suspect would be helpful. I do think there's a piece of this for the auditors. Investors want to hear from the auditors. They don't want to hear from the audit committee. They want to get the auditor's perspective, and the auditor's the one that can offer that because they're doing the audit. I do think there's a piece here for the audit committee as well. I think there's some pieces of that maybe even are best coming from the audit committee, and I also think there's some disclosures that the FASB's got to come to grips with and get out there as well that should be coming from management as opposed from the auditor audit committee. Again, I don't think you have to wait for the other two to do something. I think you can go ahead and move on your project without waiting for the others. The one thing that worries me is what John was talking about earlier. Anytime you let the attorneys get involved with writing this stuff, you got problems. And I think it's important that we don't get to where we just like what we've had with the audit committee reports. One of the reasons they've become, quite frankly, so worthless is so many of them were just written by the attorneys and they communicate almost nothing, more than what they used to, which was nothing, but they still aren't accomplishing what wasn't that good. And I also would hope that in the hearings that you held this summer, though, things like the auditor's attestation on MD&A are considered and put on the table, because, quite frankly, this is one place where I'd probably differ from Arnie's perspective. I think the auditors are in a much better position to issue a report, not at the MD&A. And I think there's some information in there investors would like to see audited. And I think they're in much better position to audit that than the securities attorneys. So I think whether or not we need attestation on that and some of the tagging and the XBRL and all, I know that's controversial as well. But I think those are things that should be part of those hearings this summer, because I think they raise some very useful questions and issues.
Thanks, Lynn. Okay, I've got Mike Gallagher, then to close it out, Gary Kaburek. Mike?
Thanks, Jennifer. A couple things. I think things will and should change. I think Lynn's point on relevance is a great one, and it's something that I think a lot about. I struggle a little bit with the practicality of how do we do it. And it gets back to John's point about thinking about my own firm having 1,000 partners in the firm in the free writing business, and which is, you know, fine. You're gonna get subjective, and this gets to the subjective versus factual. You will get subjective information that's based upon an individual's point of view, and subjective information is going to mean different things to different people. Okay, and I would say that it would depend on perhaps your level of sophistication, among other things. And that wouldn't be so bad if it was the view of the firm, any one of the firms. But it won't be. It'll be the view of the individual partner. And, you know, depending on who that partner is, what is written could be very different. Now, you could run it all through the national office, as John suggests would happen. I think that's right. But I think then you lose the color that I think people are looking for. I think the likelihood then is that it turns into boilerplate. So I struggle with how to make that operational. And again, as we communicated to Marty, that as we think about information that's going into the public domain, you know, similar to a medical oath, I think it should be first, let's do no harm. I listened to Larry, and I agree. I won't put a percentage on it like Joe did about what percentage of Larry's comments I agree with. But the notion of the role of the auditor versus the role of the preparer, I do agree with. And I think that there is an opportunity, to John's point, the more the auditor associates with, I think that does raise the game in terms of the quality of what's being associated with. So I think that's a positive. The point about AD&A, and again going back to Larry's comments, that perhaps it would be a red flag if the auditor, clean sheet of paper, had different items as critical accounting estimates than the preparer, that could be a red flag. I think theoretically that's right. As a practical matter, it would never happen because those views would get reconciled. And ultimately, as John said, the view of the auditor would prevail on that. And so you wouldn't see a lack of alignment there, which is the value of the red flag, I think, that Larry was talking about. So I think it's theoretical, but as a practical matter, it just wouldn't exist. So I know we're pressed for time, so I'll leave it there.
Thank you, Mike. Gary?
I guess if I have the last word, I better make it really quick since it's after 5 o'clock. But try to come up with some new points that weren't picked up when I wrote my first list here. But, I mean, let me begin with, I actually support changing the auditor's report, too. I might debate, is it all that important? But if the boards and the investors think it is, I'm by no means oppositional. And as I mentioned to you, some of the people here in the room last night, I think everything being discussed is physically doable. I mean, the information exists. You might debate, is it important enough? But everything on that slide is capable of being done. But understand that that comes with a price and a cost, and in some cases, unintended consequences. And a couple of ones that immediately come to mind. If you were going to have the auditor opining in the MD&A or at a very extensive ADA, is you're going to probably have to re-examine your standards on what is audit evidence. I would suggest you need to finish your communications with the audit committee standards first, because I don't think this can get done absent how do auditors interact with the audit committees get resolved first, because I think out of all of this being done, I go back to some comments I've made more than once here, is that I still don't believe the auditor's role is to communicate any new financial information about a company. I think that's management's responsibility in it. And I do think to the more and more the auditors are publicly getting associated with other things they do, is besides re-examining what is audit evidence, I think we should understand is the more and more you're being involved with stuff that's subjective or even forward-looking, the audit evidence is going to get weaker and weaker. It's one thing, you look in accounts payable, and here's the invoice, here's the check, here's the return check. That's pretty solid. But as you're starting to audit management's estimates, I think you start falling back, especially with their forward-looking estimates, if you're being associated with it, you're falling back to management's representations, no knowledge, no reason to disagree, sort of negative assurance type things. I think those are all consequences that I think will come out of this. And knowing them up front as you begin this journey, I think, would help, you know, the final product there. I certainly, you know, anything companies pay the auditors to do today, whether it's look at the MD&A, look at the press release, look at your your default communications with your banks on borrowings and stuff. I think just reporting what they do on it, not necessarily a testing, but just, again, it gets more like a comfort letter. I think that's workable. I think in the critical accounting policies section, every company will have several of them to give, like, I'll call it the French report style. Here's what we did in those areas. Again, I think we can debate, is it important enough? But I think this is what I did. I confirmed accounts. I observed inventories. I hired my own valuation expert. Just to say what you did, again, it's doable. Again, I don't know how much incremental information or, as Lynn pointed out, relevant information comes out of it, but it certainly could be done. Then my last comment is, what would be helpful to me as a preparer is if the investor advisory group here or a subset of them would come up with at least a consensus. What might a model auditor's report look like? And make up a hypothetical company, some hypothetical transactions, some hypothetical risks, recognizing they exist someplace in the world. And what would you like it to look like? Maybe there's more than one version of it, but it would really be helpful to see what the investor constituency in this room thinks the final product should look like. Then we can start working with it. I mean, you might never get there. It might even finish the project. But at least having what does the endpoint vision, at least from one constituent, look like, I think would be helpful.
Jay, you want to make a comment?
Gary, I think we have a volunteer. I think it would look a lot like Xerox.
I said investor community. If you like a management view of what it looks like, I'll just pull the one out of our report today.
Thanks for those comments, Gary and everybody else. The auditor's report is a very important project that has been mentioned a number of times. It hasn't changed in literally about 100 years in any substantive way, and investors are saying it's not a valuable product other than the audit is valuable, but the end product of the communication isn't. We're working diligently on this project, and we expect to get more information out. And, Gary, your comments about the extent to which we can lay something out in a concept release as to what it would look like, hopefully that can help respondents to the concept release give us a good input and address Mike's concerns about some of the operationality of this as well in the concept release. Very important project, and I'm very glad that everybody, as many of you, are willing to stay a little bit past scheduled time to discuss this. And I also just want to just take a moment and not keep you here much longer just to thank you all for the input we had during the day. We have a lot of important things on our plate. I mean, it's to make sure that financial statements are reliable and that audits are doing their job in ensuring that the financial statements are reliable and that there's high audit quality is the key role of what we do here in standard setting. And we talked about our standard setting agenda and changes in the accounting framework, internal control changes coming up from COSO, the importance of disclosures, and a number of very, very critical topics today. Everybody here worked very, very hard on our behalf today with all of the input that you gave us. This was not an easy day. It was a hard work day. And we very much appreciate the effort that you put in to sitting here and working hard on our behalf. So thank you for being members of this important group. We look forward to our next meeting, and safe travels home. Thank you very much.